Welcome to What the Health Podcast, where we help you lead a happier and healthier life by offering a wide range of health and wellness news and insights. I'm John Salak, your host. If you like what you hear, be sure to visit our news site at wellwellusa.com and sign up for our weekly news blasts. Now, let's get started with the show. The ugly truth is that nobody, or an extremely select few, really want to talk about what's cooking in their intestinal tract or with their bowel movements. I mean, chit-chats about chronic bloating, gas, cramps, constipation, or all too frequent bouts of diarrhea are not exactly pleasant dinnertime conversations or engaging banter. Yet it might be something we all need to spend a little more time focusing on, especially if these symptoms are severe and constant. In fact, those dealing with these type of problems may be facing a condition known as irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, a disorder that affects millions of people worldwide, including tens of millions in the U.S. alone. IBS symptoms, after all, can be devastating on a professional and social level if left untreated, which too many do because they're embarrassed to discuss their problems. Thankfully, we've lined up a leading authority on all things IBS to help us shed some light on its causes, symptoms, and treatments in hopes of helping people reduce the stress related to IBS and get their lives back on track. So keep listening. It's worth it. Welcome to What the Health Podcast. And again, this is the part everybody looks forward to when we get to delve into a subject with an expert. And we certainly have an expert on hand for this interview, and that is Dr. Megan Reel. Dr. Reel is clinical director of the GI Behavioral Health Program at the University of Michigan. And she is also the co-author of Mind Your Gut, Living Well with IBS, which gives you a clue of exactly what we're going to be talking about today. So Dr. Reel, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. We're not going to get into what happened to Michigan's basketball team this year, but I know you're probably still sort of glowing from the football win. So we'll just move right on to IBS. So IBS, exactly what is IBS? Because we hear about it, or everyone hears about it all the time.
IBS is recurrent abdominal pain, where you will have that pain in association with different bowel consistencies. So you may have constipation, you may have diarrhea, you can also have a mixed kind of bag of fluctuating from diarrhea to constipation. And we look at this over about a three-month period, and that's when we start to kind of meet the criteria. And unfortunately, with this diagnosis, a lot of people live with it for a long time before they actually then go see a doctor. But it's a complex disorder where we're learning more and more about it, but we have come so far from where we used to be. A lot of times people were told to just kind of live with it. It's not cancer. It's not inflammatory bowel disease. When you have a colonoscopy, there's no benign or an unremarkable colonoscopy with an IBS diagnosis. And so that can be very challenging for people that are living with these really uncomfortable and at many times unpredictable symptoms.
It's not a disease in and of itself. It's a condition.
It's a condition.
Is that a fair way to assess it? Or tell it's a condition.
Well,
okay.
Yeah, it's a syndrome. And really, we think that it's probably a combination of a lot of different things. And that's where it is important to meet with a doctor to get that diagnosis, because there's a lot of what we call IBS mimickers out there, like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or SIBO. Sometimes these symptoms that are similar to something like an inflammatory bowel disease, which can be Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, the treatment plan is going to be very different based on what the diagnosis is. And therefore, it really is important to talk with your doctor about all of the symptoms that you're experiencing.
How many people are affected? Is the number growing, or are we just hearing about it more?
Yeah, our number is around 45 million Americans that have IBS. And there's been lots of research to identify that number. You can find the global prevalence of between 6 and 10% of the global population. So it's prevalent. And it's kind of fun to be in a room with 100 people and kind of say, like, hey, at least 10 of you probably have this diagnosis and are living with this and coping with this and dealing with the anxieties of, is the bathroom going to be available? But I also believe, from my own just clinical clinical experience that this is probably a conservative number. And likely because recent survey study, there was one done in 2023, published in the Gastroenterology Journal, that showed that one in five people with IBS do not want to discuss their symptoms with their providers. And a quarter of people are managing their symptoms with just over-the-counter medications or non-medical treatments. And even further, a quarter mentioned that their symptoms were not bothersome enough to seek medical care. So I think that this shows that there are lots of people out there that just haven't gone to the doctor. And a lot of people have just been kind of conditioned to believe they have to live this way.
It's not surprising people don't necessarily want to talk about this sort of disorder, or at least some people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you suspect the number is growing? And I guess that may tie into, if it is growing, regardless, there's certainly a lot of people who are suffering from this or dealing with it. What's causing it?
I do think probably the number will continue to grow for a variety of reasons, to speak to your question of what's causing it. The pandemic certainly added lots of stress for people, and this is a stress-sensitive disorder where stress can impact our gut-brain axis and can lead to worsening GI symptoms or the development of symptoms. But even people that had COVID sometimes saw a worsening of GI symptoms, or that the COVID diagnosis led to some gastrointestinal conditions. So for a variety of reasons, the prevalence could be on the rise. And I think the story is unfolding here over the last 4 years of how our world has been impacted by the stress of the pandemic. And the cause of IBS is also multifactorial. So there can be environmental factors that can lead to this diagnosis, genetic factors, stress factors, psychological factors. So I always say the road to an IBS diagnosis is typically very individualized. But as we do a clinical interview with patients, it's not uncommon for them to say, growing up, my mom always had a sensitive stomach, or my dad, his family has a history of GI problems, but nobody ever sought treatment or nobody ever went to the doctor for it. So I think that there could be some kind of genetic tie there that eventually draws somebody into the clinic to talk about their symptoms. But a lot of times the factors are multifactorial, like I said, and there's a complex interactions of even food, our microbiota. And what it leads to is this impaired barrier function in your immune activation, which basically means the way the brain and the gut are communicating is dysregulated. And our goal with treatment is to try and restore it. But how we do that can include a variety of multidisciplinary strategies.
Is there a difference between the causes and the triggers for the symptoms? If you eat something or something happens, all of a sudden you're going to have this avalanche of symptoms.
So actually, I have a podcast called The Gut Health Podcast, and we just had on one of the leading experts in terms of IBS and small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, Dr. Mark Pimentel. And he highlighted that people can go on vacation or they can go to a wedding and you find out that a bunch of people got food poisoning, or you had a couple hours of diarrhea while you were on vacation and you kind of move on. And you don't really think about it. And then 3 months later, you've started to have IBS symptoms. And so it can be as unfortunate as that, where just a few hours of an exposure to something in your food can then change the functioning of your microbiota and lead to an IBS diagnosis that then they're dealing with for essentially the rest of their life. So there's that kind of exposure experience that can lead to this diagnosis. And then I can use psychological stress as another example, where we know that people that have IBS diagnoses have a higher prevalence of a history of trauma. And so people will sometimes show up in my clinic and say, yes, I had a history of trauma, but I processed that. I dealt with that. Like, I didn't have GI issues as a kid when I was dealing with all of that. And so what's the deal? Why now? And so it really just highlights the intricate nature of the way our body is and how our brain and our gut are so bidirectionally tied. And that can lead us to, unfortunately, this diagnosis.
It sounds like it's given all the different factors that are involved in either, I guess, causing it or creating the disorder or triggering the symptoms. It sounds like it's an incredibly difficult issue to deal with, either from a clinical standpoint or from a patient standpoint?
Yeah. The thing about it is that when you can't predict necessarily when you're either going to go to the bathroom too frequently or if you're struggling to go, and the thing, let's look at, so IBSD, IBS with diarrhea predominant symptoms. These patients experience that abdominal pain and then frequent diarrhea that, again, a lot of times they tie to the food that they're eating, or stress can send them to the bathroom and then it's really hard to get out. And that then makes it difficult to get to school, to get to work, to think about dating or being intimate. Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned earlier, these aren't symptoms that we tend to talk about at a cocktail party. You're not like talking, oh man, my IBS. Yeah. Although I think we are normalizing it a bit more. I have little kids and we talk all the time about everybody poops. And I want to know if you're not pooping. I want to know if you're pooping too much, because I've had so many patients that get to my office and they're in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and they're like, we never talked about going to the bathroom in our household. In fact, it was taboo. Nobody wanted to know about it. And so they didn't learn as children that going 5, 6, 7 days without going to the bathroom wasn't normal. And so I think we do have to kind of normalize. I've kind of been talking jokingly with friends, but I'm like, every kindergartner should really have a conversation about how are they pooping, proper pooping position, how frequently they should be going, that it's not normal to have a tummy ache every day, because that's what then leads to the perpetuation of some of these symptoms later in life. And IBS with constipation. More women than men will have IBS with constipation. And that's general. So women are 2.5 times more likely than men to have IBS. So it is more prevalent in women. But when we look at the prevalence types, women are more likely to have constipation. And with that comes not only the abdominal pain, but bloating, distension, which is very uncomfortable on top of not being able to pass stool. And that then impacts appetite. It impacts the pelvic floor. And we also see that those symptoms can be worsened during the menstrual cycle. So to not address any of this and to just kind of feel like you have to live with it is just like my nightmare. I want people to know that we do have ways to address it. We do have treatment. It's just a matter of, you may have to think outside of the box if you haven't made progress by working with a medical doctor.
Having done a little bit of research, millions of people walking around with IBS who probably don't know that they have IBS.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was once at a dinner table with a bunch of gastroenterologists. And so this is the most common diagnosis that most gastroenterologists will treat. And about two of them were like, yeah, I have IBS, but I've never seen a doctor for it. I just deal with it, you know? And I'm like, come on, like, this is what you do. But it's a matter of, are we too busy? Are we, I don't know. I don't know the stigma. There's certainly still a lot of stigma around this diagnosis. And I think part of my motivation and passion as an educator in this space is to talk more about it, to let people know that if you've tried medications on and off for the last 20 years and it just hasn't worked, the good news is that working with a registered dietitian can be very beneficial. Working with a GI psychologist like myself can be very beneficial. So there are other ways that we can address this diagnosis that haven't historically been available and around for all that long.
What are the symptoms? Can you lay out some of those symptoms so people can get a handle? Oh, maybe I'm dealing with this.
Yes.
And I didn't realize it.
So one thing you can do is you can Google the Bristol stool chart. And this is a chart of poop. There are types 1 to 7. And on up at the number 1 is going to be stool that's almost pebble-like. So hard to pass, pebbly stool. This is going to be obviously constipation. And from there, it kind of progresses to a number 7, which would be watery diarrhea, like the worst watery, loose diarrhea. And then in between there, a number 4 would be kind of like a smooth, snake-like stool that comes out easily. That's ideal. We want to have kind of that ideal 3-4 stool that is a normal in consistency. And so if you start at pebbles and then you're kind of lumpy and then you're progressing to loose, watery diarrhea, that's kind of stool consistency that you want to be mindful of. Color can be also one thing. So most of us, we eat different things. And so your stool won't always be brown. Like if you've had beets and you look in the toilet, you're probably going to get a little bit of a shock because your stool is going to be like a beet color. Or if you've had too much processed food coloring, then that also can change things. But generally speaking, being mindful of the color of your stool can be something to report to your doctor. And your doctor will know what you talk about if you tell them, I'm a type 1 on the Bristol stool chart, or I'm a type 7, or I'm a type 5. And so your diarrhea, your constipation, fluctuating between the both, those are symptoms to watch for. That abdominal pain, cramping, bloating, these are also symptoms that go along with this type of diagnosis. And there's also a lot of overlap in terms of pelvic floor dysfunction in this patient population. So this may be something that your listeners will take away because they've never considered working with a pelvic floor physical therapist. Because sometimes patients with IBS will have what's called dyssynergic defecation, which basically means that the functioning of the muscles needed to pass stool is not where we need it to be. And so working with a pelvic floor PT, they help strategically strengthen those muscles and learn more about the mechanics of how you're pooping, which can then help with some of those other abdominal pain, bloating type of symptoms in addition to helping pass stool easier.
Okay. Are there other symptoms that would be an indication? And I know some of these could also indicate some other problem or something else that's happening. But is there anything else, something that we forget?
So nausea, from a symptom perspective that you might not necessarily be thinking of, anxiety or depression, these are also symptoms. And they're more prevalent too in patients that have IBS. So people that have IBS are at a threefold higher risk for anxiety and depression. And so especially if the fact that you're having those other symptoms is worsening anxiety or depression, then we really want to be mindful of that correlation and that connection and address that with your medical providers.
And something like anxiety or depression could either make IBS worse, or it may be an indication you're suffering from the condition. Is that correct too?
So it is bidirectional that the chemicals in our brain that can be produced related to anxiety or depression can impact our GI tract, but also the chemicals in our GI tract can impact our brain and worsen symptoms of anxiety and depression. And also there can be very GI-specific anxieties. So for example, people that are avoiding social situations because they're afraid of having access to a bathroom or maybe having a fecal accident, which is actually also something I point out to my patients, that fecal incontinence with IBS is typically not a common symptom unless you have pelvic floor dysfunction and those muscles aren't coordinating to be able to hold the stool until it's the right time to evacuate. So if you're having a lot of bouts of fecal incontinence and you think you have IBS, you definitely want to be talking to your medical provider about that. But that's a side note. So anxiety that's related to the GI symptoms, things that we work on in behavioral therapy are addressing avoidant behaviors, helping to manage some of the catastrophic thoughts that we might have of like, oh, if I pass gas or if my stomach gurgles in a classroom or in a boardroom, I'm just going to be too mortified and people are going to think I'm gross. People are going to think that like there's something wrong with me. So I'm just going to avoid those situations. We really want to address those GI specific worries, anxieties, and stressors from a behavioral perspective. And we can do that. And then there's also something called GI specific visceral anxiety, where you feel a sensation in your stomach or your rectum or, you know, somewhere along the GI tract. And the brain really hyper-focuses on that sensation, which then ramps up anxiety. And then the anxiety makes the physical symptom worse. And it becomes this kind of dreadful cycle that people get stuck in. But the pain is real. And it's driven by nerve sensitivity. And then it's also driven by how closely the brain is focusing on those symptoms. And we know that people that are living with IBS, their brain has a more difficult time down regulating those pain signals coming from the digestive tract. And so a lot of our behavioral therapies will focus on that as well.
I wanted to just double back something you had mentioned earlier. Women are more affected than men. Do we know why that is? And are there other focal points that we should be aware of or that come to mind?
The reality is that for, I think, probably hormonal reasons, or maybe some women being more likely to go to their doctor for care. I know that sometimes my husband will be complaining of symptoms and I'm like, go to the doctor. And he's like, no, go to the doctor. And then a year later, same symptoms, go to the doctor. Oh yeah, maybe I'll go. So I think there's definitely the hormonal component is a piece that I think makes this more prevalent in women. But that being said, it's still heavily impacting men as well. So I think that we really need to continue to learn more about this. And unfortunately, though, in the research, it shows that women then have a lower quality of life compared to men when they both have IBS. Women have more fatigue. Women are more likely to have depressed mood and higher levels of anxiety. So I think we have to do a better job in the research to nail down more reasons why women are more heavily affected. And we need research dollars for that.
These are sort of the social concerns that turn into psychological stress if you're dealing with this, whether it's at work or relationships or just general social issues. Are there dangers tied to IBS that people may not realize? Or people just saying, I can live with this. Yeah, I can live with the social issues too.
From a medical perspective, you're not really at risk for anything outside of really just low quality of life, and especially those that have comorbid anxiety or depression. We don't want your depression to progress so far that you're feeling so hopeless that you experience suicidal ideation. And we have that with these patients. So I do think there's psychological risk for people that don't have the right treatment plan in place. I have patients that have severe IBS that profoundly impacts their ability to work, ability to socialize, their mood. And then I have some patients that are more on the mild end of the spectrum and they're grateful to receive treatment and get things very well controlled. But again, I think that it just depends on the severity level of IBS. And also, this diagnosis is comorbid with a lot of other diagnoses. So it's not uncommon to see endometriosis, fibromyalgia, autoimmune issues. And so if this is one of many medical issues or psychological issues that you're managing, it really is not the icing on the cake that you want to have.
General medical practitioners, are they more aware of dealing with IBS? Is this something that has grown over the last 10 or 15 years? Because with issues that the general practitioners just don't seem to deal with regularly, and not that they don't care, it just may not be the first thing they think of.
This is an evolving field where a primary care doctor can typically manage IBS pretty well, and they're likely to kind of use treatment plans based on the symptoms that the patient is having. So if they have diarrhea, they're probably going to recommend an antidiarrheal. If they have constipation, they're going to work on a laxative treatment. And the medications have become more sophisticated over the years. However, it's typically, unless you're one of the lucky patients, medication doesn't manage at all. And so there is a growing recognition that the gold standard care for IBS at this point is an integrative multidisciplinary perspective that includes not just a primary care doctor or a gastroenterologist, but a dietitian, a psychologist, a potentially pelvic floor physical therapist. We talk about this as creating your dream team in our book. And access to that, though, is still quite limited. So, you know, at the University of Michigan, we have all of that, and we can get patients access to really a wide range of subspecialists. But for those that don't have a fully integrated GI psychologist, I think the good news is digital therapeutics are emerging, and that can be something that a local gastroenterologist or primary care doctor can refer to, such as a gut-directed hypnotherapy app, or there are digital therapeutics out there that are doing GI-specific cognitive behavioral therapy. And then the field of GI nutrition is also really growing. So it's probably easier to find a GI dietitian who specializes in the variety of dietary and nutrition therapies that are recommended for IBS. And so depending on what you have access to, that's going to be what you recommend to your patients. I think as stigma reduces with IBS and more of these kind of multidisciplinary approaches become available, then people are going to be more likely to talk about them in their clinics.
Is the treatment able to eliminate IBS as a disorder, or does it just contrary?
That's a great question, because if you Google IBS, you will find a lot of snake oil out there. And what I mean by that is any product or program that says that they're going to cure your IBS, they either are unintentionally using the wrong word, or they're making a blanket statement that science has not allowed us to say is possible. So the goal with treatment is that we're able to reduce the severity of your symptoms, reduce how frequently you have symptoms, reduce how you are experiencing, so severity, frequency, and duration. That's my other one. And which means maybe you have a couple hours of abdominal pain, you've had a bout of diarrhea, or you feel like you have to go and you can't go. However, instead of getting super anxious about that and further maybe eating more foods that might exacerbate your symptoms, our goal with treatment is to empower you with a whole toolbox of strategies that you'll turn to. So that way, the symptoms are far more impactful on your quality of life. And you feel like you've got this. When you start to feel your symptoms, This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do some diaphragmatic breathing. I'm going to choose foods that are really gentle for the next couple of hours and see how I do. I'm going to keep eating. So a lot of times people will avoid food for way too long in an attempt to manage their symptoms, but the body needs to keep some food in. So whether it be as gentle as some chicken broth or something that's very easy that works for your stomach, it's important to keep kind of hydrated and getting your food into your system. But also gut-directed relaxation interventions. So these are some of the behavioral strategies that I specialize in. Being able to turn to those, knowing that they help to calm and soothe and restore the way the brain and the gut are communicating. It's really empowering for patients, and it takes people that felt like they have nothing that works to a whole bunch of different things that they can turn to.
That obviously segues neatly into my next question, which is about your book, which is entitled Mind Your Gut. How does that all fit in? I think you just touched on it a bit, but if you can outline that more and how your work can help people live well with IBS.
So there you go. Mind Your Gut, the science-based whole body guide to living well with IBS. And I co-wrote it with the world-renowned GI dietitian, Kate Scarlatta. And it's kind of the first of its kind book that we help you understand the IBS diagnosis. We review the science, we review the pathophysiology, so the mechanics of IBS. And as I was talking about that really unique roadmap that each individual with IBS might fall into, to land at an IBS diagnosis. And then from there, we have several chapters dedicated to reviewing nutrition, where Kate highlights the evidence, the science, not just for the low FODMAP diet, which is an evidence-based nutrition therapy for IBS, but you know, we highlight that not everybody needs to follow a restrictive diet to manage their IBS. Maybe they could benefit from following some of our suggestions for a gentle diet cleanup, which again, kind of falls into what are the foods that are easy on your stomach. We list out foods that we give you lots of different options. We give you recipes to help you have a healthy gut, a diverse microbiome that's so important for all of us. My chapters cover behavioral strategies that you can implement from home. So different relaxation strategies. I give an overview of stress management interventions that can be really helpful, not only for your IBS, but just for all of us have stress and we can all benefit from some good strategies there. And then I dive into some of the science related to the benefits of using gut-directed relaxation, which stem from the world of gut-directed hypnotherapy. And then we also have several chapters that talk about very symptom-specific strategies. We cover the science on medications, probiotics, prebiotics. We give you our thoughts and opinions as well as what the literature says. And then the very end of the book is filled with lots of different resources. So some of those digital therapeutics that are available on the market that can be helpful from a behavioral strategy, different food companies that are really great from a gut-friendly perspective. And as I mentioned, we have a whole section for different really amazing recipes that are also wonderful for your gut.
You mentioned research and research support for IBS. Now, I've never spoken to any medical professional who thinks their field has enough research dollars, but has there been growing support for IBS research? How does it stack up against other issues or funding that's needed in other areas?
I think that you're absolutely right. There's never enough. And I think the more that we can destigmatize this diagnosis and recognize how complex it is, the cool thing is that the more we learn about the microbiome, and we're just skimming the surface on what we're going to learn about the microbiome, this type of research is really something that we're looking for research funding and research dollars around, because we've found that even using some of our psychological therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy in very preliminary research has shown that it impacts the brain-gut microbiome axis, which is going to impact our GI symptoms. So I can't personally speak to exactly the dollars and cents of how this stacks up across medical diagnoses, but by far, it doesn't receive as much funding as cancer or some of our other major diagnoses out there.
What are the biggest misconceptions out there about IBS? So people can sort of push those aside as well.
I think one is that you just have to live with it. And that if you've tried a couple different medications and you haven't had relief, that there's nothing out there that's going to work for you. Because I think a lot of times people turn to probiotics and prebiotics. And again, those are things that potentially could work, but the science just doesn't support it at this particular time. In fact, the major guidelines for gastroenterology don't recommend use of probiotics because everybody's microbiome is so different. And so I think that there are great natural ways that you can also address your microbiome and natural prebiotics and probiotics from food. Mm-hmm. And so that's one area that you can look at. And then also taking a look at your overall mental health. If you feel like your symptoms of diarrhea, constipation, abdominal pain are really precluding you from engaging in the life that you want to have, then working with a mental health provider who is expert in this area of health can really give you concrete tools and strategies to help you address those feelings and those symptoms. The timeline of treatment really can range from about 5 to 10 sessions, and people can have a really profound impact on their overall quality of life and onward they go. So I think if you're somebody that has just been living with this, then check out our book where we have a lot of different options. Listen to our podcast that's focused tremendously on overall gut health, and don't stop looking for a provider who will really listen to you and help create the treatment plan that's going to get you feeling better.
Okay. Dr. Real, that's all great advice. And underscore that you don't have to live with IBS. It can be dealt with. You don't have to carry that burden with you. So thank you very much for all the insight, all the information. Please look into Mind Your Gut, Living Well with IBS. So Dr. Real, thank you very much. And hopefully we can talk about this or some other element going forward.
I would love
that. Thank you for visiting with us.
Thank you so much for having me on to talk about this very important topic. Thank you.
Before we move on, we wanted to again encourage listeners to take advantage of the hundreds of exclusive discounts Wellwell offers on a range of health and wellness products and services. These cover everything from fitness and athletic equipment to dietary supplements, personal care products, organic foods and beverages, and more. Signing up is easy and free. Just visit us at wellwellusa.com. Go to Milton's Discounts on the top menu bar and the sign-up form will appear. Signing up will take seconds, but the benefits can last for years. Okay, when it comes to IBS, I think we all realize now that the consequences can be pretty nasty. But the issue can be dealt with. But there's some don'ts and some do's. First, the don'ts. Don't be embarrassed. You're not alone. IBS is a common mind-gut disorder. Don't wait. Seek professional help right away. IBS is not going to get better on its own. Don't be fooled by false ads boasting IBS cures. They are not going to help. You need professional help. Don't get discouraged. These symptoms can be brought under control. But with these don'ts, there are a couple of do's. Do get professional help. Your doctor, your primary care physician, whomever. Do remember that all treatments are not effective for every person. Solutions vary by person, but help is available that will get these conditions, these symptoms, under control. Well, that's it for this episode of What the Health. We'd like to thank Dr. Megan Reel, Director of the GI Behavioral Health Program at the University of Michigan. Her insights were great. Dr. Reel is also the co-author of Mind Your Gut, the science-based whole-body guide to living well with IBS. We'd recommend everyone who is dealing with IBS or who may think they have some IBS issues to get a copy and learn more about living well with IBS. Again, that's it for this episode of What the Health. Thanks for listening in, and we hope you'll join us again. Thanks for listening to this episode of What the Health. Looking for more feel-good news? Just visit our news site at wellwellusa.com and sign up for our weekly news blast. And if you enjoyed this episode and would like to help support our podcast, please share it with others, post it on social media, or leave a rating and review. Until next time, keep yourself on that pathway to a healthier, happier you.